bacteria remain dormant, encased by the calcium silicate hydrate fibrils. But if a crack forms, the bacteria are released from their bonds, and in the presence of water they wake up and start to look around for food. They find the starch that has been added to the concrete, and this allows them to grow and replicate. In the process, they excrete calcite, a form of calcium carbonate. This calcite bonds to the concrete and starts to build up a mineral structure that spans the crack, stopping further growth of the crack and sealing it up. It's the sort of idea that might sound good in theory but never work in practice, but it does work. Research now shows that cracked concrete that has been prepared in this way can recover 90% of its strength thanks to these bacteria. This self-healing concrete is now being developed for use in real engineering structures. Another type of concrete with a living component is called filtercrete. This is a concrete that has very particular porosity, such that it allows naturally occurring bacteria to colonize it. The pores in the concrete also allow water to flow through it, reducing the need for drains, while the bacteria inside the concrete purify the water by decomposing oils and other contaminants. And there is also now a textile version of concrete called concrete cloth. This material comes in a roll and needs only water to be added for it to harden into any shape you like. Although this material has great sculptural potential, perhaps its biggest application may be in disaster zones, where tents made in situ from rolls of concrete dropped from the air can create a temporary city in a matter of days, one that will keep out the rain, wind, and sun for years while rebuilding efforts continue. What happened next at the Shard, though, was no such celebration of concrete's potential. Instead, the builders were slowly but systematically cladding the outside of the Shard with steel and glass to remove all traces of its concrete core. The implication was stark. They were ashamed of concrete. It had no place in how this building was to face the outside world or its inhabitants. This attitude is shared by most people. Concrete is perceived as fine for the construction of a motorway bridge or for a hydroelectric dam, but it is not deemed a suitable material for building within a city. The use of concrete to express a sense of freedom and liberty, as in London's South Bank Centre in the 1960s, is now unthinkable. The 1960s were heady days for concrete. It was used boldly to reinvent city centres, to build a modern world. But somewhere along the way, this association was lost, and people decided it wasn't the material of the future after all. Perhaps too many poor-quality concrete multi-story car parks were built, too many people were mugged in graffiti-covered concrete underpasses, or too many families felt dehumanized by living in a concrete high-rise estate. These days, concrete is regarded as necessary, cheap, functional, grey, dreary, stained, inhuman, but most of all, ugly. But the truth is that cheap design is cheap design, whatever the material. Steel can be used in good or bad design, as can wood or bricks. But it is only with concrete that the epithet of ugly has stuck. There is nothing intrinsically poor about the aesthetics of concrete. You only have to look at the Sydney Opera House, whose iconic shell enclosures are made of concrete, or the interiors of London's Barbican Centre to realize that the material is capable of, and in fact makes possible, the greatest and most extraordinary architecture. This has not changed since the 1960s. It is the look of concrete that is now felt to be unacceptable, which means that concrete is now routinely hidden away from sight, providing the core and foundations but not allowed to be visible. Many new versions of concrete have been invented to refresh its aesthetic appeal. The latest is self-cleaning concrete, which contains titanium dioxide particles. These sit on its surface but are microscopic and transparent, so it looks no different. However, when they absorb UV light from the sun, the particles create free radical ions, which break down any organic dirt that comes into contact with them. The remains are washed away by the rain or blown away by the wind. A church in Rome called Dives in Misericordia has been constructed with such self-cleaning concrete. In fact, the titanium dioxide does more than clean the concrete. It can also reduce the level of nitrogen oxide in the air produced by cars like a catalytic converter. Several studies have shown that this works and open up the possibility that in the future buildings and roads may not be purely passive. They may purify the air, much like plants. Now that the Shard is complete, all the concrete is hidden from sight, encased in more acceptable materials. But our ugly secret, and that of the shard, is that concrete is literally the foundation of our whole society. It is the basis of our cities, our roads, our bridges, our power stations. It is 50% of everything we make. But like bone, we prefer it on the inside. When it sticks out, we are repulsed. This may not be a permanent situation. Maybe it is just the end of the second wave of enthusiasm for concrete. The first was started by the Romans and ended for mysterious reasons. The new concrete that is coming along is more sophisticated and may yet reverse our tastes again, igniting a third wave of enthusiasm, this time for smart concrete with embedded bacteria that allow it to create living, breathing architecture, thus changing our relationship with this most fundamental of materials. 4. Delicious. Take a piece of dark chocolate and pop it in your mouth. For a few moments you will feel its hard corners against your palate and tongue, but taste little in the way of flavor. It is almost impossible to resist the urge to give it a good bite, but try very hard not to, so that you can experience what happens next, the lump becoming suddenly limp as it absorbs the heat from your tongue. As it becomes liquid, you will notice your tongue feels cooler, and then a combination of sweet and bitter flavors floods your mouth. These are followed by fruity and nutty sensations, and finally an earthy, muddy taste down the back of your throat. For one blissful moment, you will be enthralled to the most deliciously engineered material on earth. Chocolate is designed to transform into a liquid as soon as it hits your mouth. This trick is the culmination of hundreds of years of culinary and engineering effort, aimed initially at creating a popular drink that could hold its own against tea and coffee. That effort failed miserably until chocolate manufacturers realized that making hot chocolate in the mouth instead of in a saucepan was much more delightful, much more modern, and far more widely liked. In effect, they created a solid drink, made possible by their understanding and control of crystals, specifically cocoa butter crystals. The chocolate industry has never looked back. Cocoa butter is one of the finest fats in the vegetable kingdom, slugging it out with dairy butter and olive oil for pole position. In its pure form, it looks like fine unsalted butter and is the basis not just of chocolate but of luxury face creams and lotions. Don't let this put you off. Fats have always provided humans with more than just food in the form of candles, creams, oil lamps, polish, and soap. But cocoa butter is a special fat for many reasons. For one, it melts at body temperature, meaning that it can be stored as a solid but becomes a liquid when it comes into contact with the human body. This makes it ideal for lotions. Moreover, it contains natural antioxidants which prevent rancidity, so it can be stored for years without going off. Compare that to butter made from milk, which has a shelf life of only a few weeks. This is good news for face cream makers, but also for chocolate manufacturers. Cocoa fat has another trick up its sleeve. It forms crystals, and these are what give chocolate bars their mechanical strength. The major component of cocoa butter is a large molecule called a triglyceride, which forms crystals in many different ways, depending on how these triglycerides are stacked together. It's a bit like packing the trunk of a car. There are many ways to do it, but some take up more space than others. The more tightly packed the triglycerides, the more compact the crystals of cocoa fat. And the denser the cocoa fat, the higher its melting point and the more stable and stronger it is. These denser forms of cocoa are also the hardest to make. Types 1 and 2 crystals, as they are called, are mechanically soft and quite unstable. They will, if given any chance at all, transform into the denser types 3 and 4. Nevertheless, they are useful for making chocolate coatings on ice creams because their low melting point of 16 degrees Celsius allows them to melt in the mouth even when cooled by the ice cream. Types 3 and 4 crystals are soft and crumbly and have no brittle snap when broken. The mechanical property of the snap is important to chocolatiers because it adds surprise and drama to our experience of the chocolate. For example, it allows them to create hard outer shells with which to encase soft centers, providing a textural contrast. From a psychophysics perspective, meanwhile, brittleness and the sound associated with cracking open a chocolate are linked with freshness, which again adds to the enjoyment of eating chocolate with a snap. Anyone who has tucked into a bar of chocolate expecting it to be hard and brittle only to find it gooey and melted knows just how disappointing losing the snap can be. Although it is fair to say that gooey chocolate has its place as well. For all these reasons, chocolate makers tend to want to avoid types 3 and 4 crystals, but unfortunately they are the easiest to create. If you melt some chocolate and then let it cool down, you will almost certainly form types 3 and 4 crystals. This chocolate feels soft to the touch, has a matte finish, and melts easily in the hand. These crystals will transform into the more stable type 5 over time, but on the way they will eject some sugar and fat, which will appear as white powder on the surface of the chocolate, called bloom. Type 5 is an extremely dense fat crystal. It gives the chocolate a hard, glossy surface with an almost mirror-like finish and a pleasing snap when broken. It has a higher melting point than the other crystal types, melting at 34 degrees Celsius, and so only melts in your mouth. Because of these attributes, the aim of most chocolatiers is to make type 5 cocoa butter crystals. This is easier said than done. They have to be created through a process called tempering, in which preformed seed type 5 crystals are added during the final process of solidification. These give the slower-growing type 5 crystals a head start over the faster-growing type 3 and 4 crystals, allowing the whole liquid mass to solidify into the denser form of crystal structure before the type 3 and 4 crystals have a chance to get going. When you put pure dark chocolate into your mouth and sense it start to liquefy, what you are feeling are the type 5 cocoa butter crystals that are holding the chocolate together starting to wobble. If they have been cared for properly, they will have spent their entire life at temperatures below 18 degrees Celsius. Now, in your mouth, they experience higher temperatures for the first time. This is the moment they have been created for. It is their first and last performance. As they warm up and reach the threshold of 34 degrees Celsius, they start to melt. This change from solid to liquid, a so-called transformation of state, requires energy to break the atomic bonds that are holding the molecules of a crystal together, thus freeing them to move around as a liquid. So as the chocolate reaches its melting point, it takes this extra energy that it needs from your body. The chocolate gets this energy in the form of latent heat, as it is called, from your tongue. You perceive it as a pleasant cooling effect, similar almost to sucking a mint. It's the same cooling effect that is produced when you sweat, but rather than a solid becoming a liquid, instead, a liquid, your sweat, changes state into a gas, absorbing the latent heat required to do so from your skin. Plants use the same process to cool themselves down. In the case of cocoa crystals, the coolness of the chocolate melting is accompanied by the sudden production of a warm, thick liquid in the mouth, and it is this wild combination of impressions that is responsible for the unique feel of chocolate in the mouth. It is the beginning of the hot chocolate experience. What happens next is that the ingredients of the chocolate, once bound together by the rigid cocoa butter matrix, are now free to flow to your taste buds. The grains of the cocoa nut, which were once encapsulated in the solid cocoa butter, are now released. Dark chocolate usually contains 50% cocoa fat and 20% cocoa nut powder, referred to as 70% cocoa solids on the packaging. Almost all the rest is sugar. 30% sugar is a lot. It's the equivalent of putting a spoonful of sugar in your mouth. Nevertheless, dark chocolate isn't overly sweet. Sometimes it's not sweet at all. This is because at the same time that the sugars are released by the melting cocoa butter, so are chemicals known as alkaloids and phenolics from the cocoa powder. These are molecules such as caffeine and theobromine, which are extremely bitter and astringent. They activate the bitter and sour taste receptors and complement the sweetness of the sugar. Balancing these basic tastes to give the chocolate a rounded flavor is the first task of the chocolatier. The addition of salt as a flavor enhancer, as well as adding another dimension to modern chocolates, has in turn led to chocolate being used as an ingredient in savory dishes. It is the basis of the Mexican dish pollo con mole, which is a chicken cooked in dark chocolate. However, cooked chocolate tastes different from eating chocolate for another reason. Although basic taste is generated on the tongue by the taste buds, which distinguish between bitter, sweet, salty, sour, and umami, meaty or savory, most flavor is experienced through smell. It is the smell of chocolate from within your own mouth that is responsible for its complex taste. When you cook chocolate, many of its flavor molecules evaporate or are destroyed by the cooking. This is a problem not just for hot chocolate, but also for coffee and tea. It is why you need to drink those drinks within minutes of being brewed, otherwise the flavor disappears into the air. It is also why you lose much of your sense of taste when you have a cold, because the smell receptors in the nose are covered by mucus. The genius of creating hot chocolate in the mouth is that the cocoa butter encapsulates the flavor molecules until the moment you eat it, and only then does it release its cocktail of more than 600 exotic molecules into your mouth and up your nose. Some of the first flavors that you detect up your nose are fruity ones belonging to the ester family of molecules. These molecules are responsible for the ripe smell of beer, wine, and more obviously, fruits. But these esters are not present in the raw cocoa bean. I know this because I've eaten a raw cocoa bean and it tastes horrible. It is fibrous, woody, bitter, and bland. There is no fruitiness, no hint of a chocolate taste, and certainly no reason to taste one again. It takes quite a bit of engineering to turn these rather exotic-looking but dull-tasting beans into chocolate. So much so, in fact, that it gets you wondering how it was ever invented at all. Cocoa trees grow in tropical climates and produce fruit in the form of large, fleshy cocoa pods. These look like some form of wild and leathery orange or purple melon. The pods grow directly out of the trunk of the tree rather than from a branch, making them seem suspiciously unevolved and prehistoric. You can imagine dinosaurs trying to eat them and spitting them out. Inside each pod, there are 30 to 40 soft, white, fat, almond-shaped seeds the size of small plums. On my first encounter with these cocoa nuts, I popped one in my mouth and chewed it excitedly. And then I spat it out as soon as I realized what it tasted like. I wondered if it really was a cocoa nut and was told that it was. "But it doesn't taste of chocolate," I complained, dripping with sweat. I was at the time helping to pick the cocoa pods on a Honduran cocoa plantation while simultaneously being attacked by mosquitoes. Disappointment and discomfort notwithstanding, I realized I was being petulant and that I must have sounded like one of the gold ticket holders from Roald Dahl's book Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The setting, too, was almost fictionally exotic. The small, gnarled cocoa trees were growing in the shade of banana and coconut trees, stuffed with fruit, whose leaves filtered the bright sun into a thousand shades of green. What happened next was straight out of the Willy Wonka school of chocolate making, too. We harvested the cocoa beans using machetes and then deposited them in a heap on the ground, where we left them to rot. I found out later that this is not an eccentric custom of Honduran cocoa farmers. It is how all chocolate is made. Over 2 weeks, the heaps of beans start to decompose and ferment, and in the process they heat up. This serves the purpose of killing the cocoa seeds, inasmuch as it stops them from germinating into cocoa plants. But more importantly, it chemically transforms the raw ingredients of the cocoa bean into the precursors of the chocolate flavors. If this step doesn't take place, whatever else you do, you won't get anything remotely like chocolate. It is during fermentation that the fruity ester molecules are created, the result of a reaction between the alcohols and the acids that are created by enzymes acting within the cocoa beans. As with all chemical reactions, there are a vast number of different variables that affect this outcome. The ratio of the ingredients, the surrounding temperature, the availability of oxygen, and many others. This means that the taste of chocolate is highly dependent not just on the ripeness and species of the cocoa bean, but also on how high the rotting piles of beans are stacked, how long they are left to rot, and generally what the weather is like. If all this makes you wonder why chocolate makers rarely talk about these subtleties, it is because they are a secret. On the face of it, cocoa seems to be like other commodities, a basic ingredient like sugar that is bought and sold on world markets, fueling a billion-dollar industry in edible products. But what is much less talked about is that, just like coffee and tea, different varieties of bean and different techniques of preparation create vastly different tastes. A detailed understanding of both is required to buy the right beans, and when it comes to creating the finest chocolates, this knowledge is closely guarded. Controlling quality, meanwhile, also means taking into account the variability of tropical weather and the sporadic influx of disease. All in all, producing quality chocolate requires a huge amount of care and attention, which is why good dark chocolate is expensive. What you get for your money, though, is not just the delicate fruity flavors from the fermented esters, but a set of earthy, nutty, almost meaty flavors. These are produced in the process that comes after fermentation, when the beans are dried and roasted. As with coffee making, roasting turns each bean into a mini chemical factory, in which a new set of reactions takes place. First, the carbohydrates within the bean, which are mostly sugar and starch molecules, start to fall apart because of the heat. This is essentially the same thing that happens if you heat up sugar in a pan. It caramelizes. Only in this case, the caramelizing reaction takes place inside the cocoa bean, turning it from white to brown and creating a wonderful range of nutty caramel flavor molecules. The reason why any sugar molecule, whether in a cocoa bean or a pan or anywhere else, turns brown when heated is to do with the presence of carbon. Sugars are carbohydrates, which is to say that they are made of carbon, carbo, hydrogen, hydra, and oxygen, 8 atoms. When heated, these long molecules disintegrate into smaller units, some of which are so small that they evaporate, which accounts for the lovely smell. On the whole, it is the carbon-rich molecules that are larger, so these get left behind, and within these there is a structure called a carbon-carbon double bond. This chemical structure absorbs light. In small amounts, it gives the caramelizing sugar a yellow-brown color. Further roasting will turn some of the sugar into pure carbon, double bonds all around, which creates a burnt flavor and a dark brown color. Complete roasting results in charcoal. All of the sugar has become carbon, which is black. Another type of reaction, which occurs at a higher temperature, also contributes to the color and flavor of the cocoa, the Maillard reaction. This is when a sugar reacts with a protein. If carbohydrates are the fuel of the cellular world, proteins are the workhorses, the structural molecules that build cells and all their internal workings. Seeds, in the form of nuts or beans, must contain all of the proteins needed to get the cellular machinery of a plant up and running, so there is plenty of protein in the cocoa beans. When subjected to temperatures of 160 degrees Celsius and above, these proteins and carbohydrates start to undergo Maillard reactions, reacting with the acids and esters produced by the earlier fermentation process and resulting in a huge range of smaller flavor molecules. It is no exaggeration to say that without the Maillard reaction, the world would be a much less delicious place. It is the Maillard reaction that is responsible for the flavor of bread crust, roasted vegetables, and many other roasted savory flavors. In this case, the Maillard reaction is responsible for the nutty, meaty flavors of chocolate, while also reducing some of the astringency and bitterness. Grind up the fermented and roasted coconuts and add them to hot water, and you have the original hot chocolatl, made by the Mesoamericans. The Olmecs and then the Mayans, who first cultivated chocolate, drank it this way, and it was revered as a ceremonial drink and an aphrodisiac for hundreds of years. The coconuts were even used as currency. When European explorers got hold of the drink in the 17th century, they exported it to coffee houses, where it competed with tea and coffee to be the beverage of choice of Europeans, and lost. What no one had really mentioned was that chocolatl means bitter water, and even though it was sweetened with the new cheap sugar flooding in from the slave-run plantations of Africa and South America, it was also a gritty, oily, and heavy drink, because 50% of the cocoa bean is cocoa fat. This is how it remained for another 200 years, an exotic drink, notable but not terribly popular. With the invention of a few industrial processes, though, chocolate's fortunes suddenly changed. The first was the screw press, invented by a Dutch chocolate company called Van Houten in 1828. Crushing the fermented roasted beans with this press forced the cocoa butter to flow out and allowed Van Houten to separate it from the remaining cocoa solids. Now free of much of its fat, the cocoa could be ground down into a much finer powder and so lost its grittiness, becoming smooth, sleek, and velvety. It was in this form that cocoa now became popular, and survives to this day, as drinking chocolate. Then came a moment of counterintuitive genius. Having removed and purified the cocoa fat, and having pulverized the cocoa powder separately, why not mix them back together again, adding in some sugar to create an ideal cocoa bean, the kind of bean you would want to pick from a tree, the kind of bean with exactly the right combination of sugar, chocolate flavor, and fat that would exist in a Willy Wonka world. There were many chocolatiers in Belgium, Holland, and Switzerland who experimented with this approach, but it was an English firm called Fry and Sons that became famous for producing such nodules of eating chocolate, and in doing so created the first chocolate bars. As the purified cocoa butter melted in the mouth, it released the cocoa powder, producing instant hot chocolate, a sensation that was completely unique. Because the cocoa fat content could be controlled separately from the cocoa powder and the sugar, it was now possible to design different types of sensations in the mouth to suit different tastes. And in a time before refrigerators, the cocoa butter's antioxidant properties meant that chocolate made in this way had a long enough shelf life to become a commercial product. The chocolate industry was born. For some, even with the addition of 30% sugar, this form of chocolate was still too bitter, and so another ingredient was added, one that profoundly affected its taste, milk. This reduces the chocolate's astringency quite considerably, giving the cocoa an altogether milder and the resulting chocolate an altogether sweeter flavor. The Swiss were the first to do this in the 19th century, adding the plentiful milk powder produced by the fledgling Nestlé company, which itself was transforming milk from a local fresh product with a short life into a transportable commodity with a long one. The merging of the two commercial products, both with a long shelf life, was an enormous hit. These days, the type of milk added to chocolate varies widely throughout the world, and this is the main reason that milk chocolate tastes different from country to country. In the USA, the milk used has had some of its fat removed by enzymes, giving the chocolate a cheesy, almost rancid flavor. In the UK, sugar is added to liquid milk, and it is this solution, reduced to a concentrate, that is added to the chocolate, creating a milder caramel flavor. In Europe, powdered milk is still used, giving the chocolate a fresh dairy flavor with a powdery texture. These different tastes do not travel well. Despite globalization, the preferred taste of milk chocolate, once acquired, remains surprisingly regional. One thing that all milk chocolate has in common, though, is that almost all of the milk's water content has been removed before it is added. This is because chocolate powder is hydrophilic, water-loving. Given a chance, it will absorb water, but in doing so, it will eject its fat coating. Water and fat will not dissolve in one another, in the process decomposing into a lumpy liquid much like the Mayan chocolatl. Anyone who has ever tried to add water to melted chocolate to create a sauce will have experienced this problem. There are plenty of people, including myself, who are addicted to eating chocolate, and the reason may not just be its taste. It also contains psychoactive ingredients. The most familiar one is caffeine, which is present in small proportions in the cocoa bean, and so ends up in the chocolate via the cocoa powder. The other psychoactive ingredient is theobromine, which is a stimulant and antioxidant, like caffeine, but is also highly toxic to dogs. Many dogs die every year from eating chocolate, mainly around Easter and Christmas. Theobromine's effect on humans appears to be much milder, and the stimulant levels in chocolate are small when compared to coffee and tea, so even if you eat a dozen chocolate bars every day, it is only equivalent to drinking one or two cups of strong coffee. Chocolate also contains cannabinoids, which are the chemicals responsible for the high experienced from smoking dope. But again, the percentages are tiny, and when blind taste studies were carried out to analyze chocolate cravings, researchers found little evidence that any of these chemicals were linked to feelings of craving. This leaves another possibility to explain chocolate addiction. Rather than its being a chemical effect, it may be that the sensory experience of eating chocolate is itself addictive. Chocolate is like no other food. When chocolate melts in the mouth, it suddenly releases a wild and complex, sweet and bitter cocktail of flavors within a warm, rich liquid. It is not just a flavor, but an entire oral experience. It is soothing and comforting, but it's also exciting and, not to put too fine a point on it, seems to satisfy more than a physical hunger. Some say that eating chocolate is better than kissing, and scientists have dutifully tested this hypothesis by carrying out a set of experiments. In 2007, a team led by Dr. David Lewis recruited pairs of passionate lovers, whose brain activity and heart rate were monitored first while they kissed each other, and then while they ate chocolate, separately. The researchers found that although kissing set the heart pounding, the effect did not last as long as when the participants ate chocolate. The study also showed that when the chocolate started melting, all regions of the brain received a boost far more intense and longer-lasting than the brain activity measured while kissing. Although this is just a single study, it does give credibility to the hypothesis that for many, the sensory experience of eating chocolate is better than kissing. This association of chocolate with extreme sensory pleasure has been energetically promoted by chocolate manufacturers, most notably, perhaps, in the long-running television adverts for Cadbury's Flake chocolate bar. The first flake advert I ever saw featured a woman having a terrific time in the bath. I was young at the time, and baths did not fill me with the kind of delight that this woman was experiencing. For me, baths were functional and usually cold, since my three older brothers had been in the bath before me. This was the 1970s. Energy was expensive and hot water was in short supply in our house. Baths were only jolly when I was allowed to bring my boats in with me. The woman on the TV didn't have toys of any kind, but instead was equipped merely with a flake chocolate bar. Every time she put some of it into her mouth, waves of contentment seemed to possess her, which would give her what seemed like the purest kind of pleasure. I realized that I'd never experienced this kind of sensation at all, let alone in a bath. The advert had a strong impact on me and my brothers, and we tried to get our mum to allow us to eat chocolate in our cold baths, but without any luck. Instead, she banned us from watching the adverts, an unenforceable directive because we didn't have a TV, and only saw the Lady of the Flake when we stayed at our friends' houses. It was only much later that I realized it wasn't chocolate in the bath that she was trying to protect us from. These adverts, which began in the late 1950s and continue to this day, always feature a woman relaxing on her own while indulging in the secret pleasure of eating flake. The shape and size of this rod-like chocolate, and the suggestive manner in which the woman indulged in it, were enough to send waves of outrage and alarm through the viewing public, despite the fact that the adverts never showed any nudity, merely implying it. It was, after all, an exercise wholly in suggestion. Indeed, a search on YouTube, where the original adverts have been uploaded, shows that the early versions were far more suggestive than recent ones. But while the call to censor these adverts was successful, their essential message has remained, and it does seem to resonate with the public, perhaps even pointing to a genuine truth about chocolate. For many, it is better than sex. In a list of the countries with the highest consumption of chocolate, Switzerland comes top, followed by Austria, Ireland, Germany, and Norway. In fact, 16 of the 20 countries with the highest chocolate consumption are Northern European. In America, chocolate is more popular as a flavor than as a bar, with more than half the population saying they preferred chocolate drinks, cakes, and biscuits than any other flavor. Given the reputation of chocolate as a substitute for sex, it is tempting to draw all sorts of cultural conclusions from this correlation. But there is another possible explanation for the high chocolate consumption in these countries, which is also associated with temperature. In order to transform from a solid to a liquid easily within the mouth, chocolate requires a fairly cool ambient temperature. In a climate that is too warm, chocolate will either melt on the shelf or need to be put in the fridge, which defeats the purpose entirely. Cold chocolate gets swallowed before it's had a chance to melt. This problem may explain perhaps why the Mesoamericans who first invented chocolate in the tropics never created a solid bar but consumed it only as a drink. Moreover, if solid chocolate is exposed to temperatures above 20 degrees Celsius, as a result perhaps of being left in the sun or in a hot car, it undergoes fundamental changes of structure. The changes can be spotted immediately because they result in bloom. Fat and sugars migrate to the surface of the chocolate and form a whitish crystalline powder, often with a river mark pattern. As well as pure pleasure, chocolate's high sugar content and the perceived stimulating effects of the caffeine and theobromine have carved out another role for chocolate, encapsulated by the slogan, "A Mars a day helps you work, rest, and play." Or its French equivalent, un coup de barre, Mars et ça repart. Feeling beat, a Mars and you're off again. Or its German one, nimm Mars, gib Gas. Take Mars, step on the gas. With an average chocolate bar containing more than 50% sugar and 30% fat, it clearly offers a concentrated source of energy and an instant lift. For these same reasons, though, the healthiness of chocolate-rich diets has been called into question. Cocoa butter is a saturated fat, a class of fat associated with an increased risk of heart disease. Further investigation into how the body digests this fat has shown, however, that it tends to convert this fat into unsaturated fat, which is thought to be benign. Meanwhile, the cocoa particles contain an enormous range of antioxidants, and no one really knows what they get up to in the body. However, controlled studies by Harvard University have shown that the regular consumption of a small amount of dark chocolate leads to an increased life expectancy, as compared to the consumption of no chocolate at all. No one knows why, and further studies are ongoing. Of course, if the craving for chocolate becomes too much, any benefits will be offset by weight gain. At the moment, the jury is still out, but leaving aside overconsumption, chocolate is no longer seen as damaging to our health and perhaps even as beneficial. For all these reasons, although we are a long way from doctors prescribing chocolate or children being given it as part of a school diet, chocolate is an integral item in many countries' standard military rations. It provides a sugar boost for energy, caffeine and theobromine for brain stimulation, and fats to replenish those lost during extreme exercise, and it has a shelf life of several years. Finally, but most controversially, it also may stave off feelings of sexual frustration. Personally, I eat chocolate obsessively every afternoon and every night. Whether this is down to the brainwashing I received watching flake adverts, or a psychophysical addiction, or sexual repression due to a Northern European upbringing, I am not sure. I prefer to think it's because I truly appreciate that chocolate is one of our greatest engineering creations. It is certainly no less remarkable and technically sophisticated than concrete or steel. Through sheer ingenuity, we have found a way to turn an unpromising tropical rainforest nut that tastes revolting into a cold, dark, brittle solid designed for one purpose only, to melt in your mouth, flood your senses with warm, fragrant, bittersweet flavors, and ignite the pleasure centers of the brain. Despite our scientific understanding, words or formulae are not enough to describe it. It is as close as we get, I would say, to a material poem, as complex and beautiful as a sonnet. Which is why the Linnaean name for the stuff, Theobroma, is so appropriate. It means the food of the gods. 5. Marvelous. One day in 1998, I walked into the lab just as one of the technicians was taking a piece of material out of the microscope. "I'm not sure if you're allowed to see this," he said, "so we'd better be on the safe side, otherwise I'm going to have to fill in a load of paperwork." He quickly covered up the material. I was working for the U.S. government at the time in a nuclear weapons laboratory in the desert of New Mexico. Being a British citizen, I had only the basic security clearance, and so there were areas in the laboratory complex I couldn't go. Most areas, in fact. But this was our lab, so the behavior of the technician was definitely odd. I knew better than to ask him more. This was the late 1990s, a time when Chinese espionage in U.S. national laboratories was a very sensitive issue. The American scientist Wen-Ho Lee had just been caught, indicted, and put in solitary confinement on a charge of stealing nuclear secrets for China. He was eventually only charged with improper handling of secure data, to which he pleaded guilty. The judge eventually apologized to him for the solitary confinement. I was regularly interviewed about the security issues surrounding my work, and my U.S. colleagues were under increasing pressure to report any conversations that were out of the ordinary. For a British person like me, with an inquiring mind and a fondness of joking around, asking unnecessary questions was a risky business. The material, though, was extraordinary, and although I only saw a small fragment of it for a mere second, I found it impossible to forget. Our research team would regularly go for lunch together at the various cafeterias near the laboratory complex. This meant leaving the air-conditioned safety of our building and striking out into the bright desert to pick up our cars from the sun-drenched asphalt parking lot. On the way, we passed high wire fences beyond which the orange sand, dotted with cacti, stretched out to an Air Force base. The place was unreal in so many ways, but made more so by its contrast with our mundane routines. Driving through the desert in a convoy of cars, which had been heated to boiling point by the unblinking sun, to the cafeterias serving Tex-Mex cuisine was one such routine. Day after day, we would chat about nothing, our conversation bleached by the heat. Day after day, the thought of the mystery material would pop into my head and I would wonder what on earth it could be. The fact that I couldn't talk to anyone about it made it all the more difficult to forget. I remembered it as being transparent, yet strangely opalescent, like a hologram of a jewel, a ghost material. I had definitely seen nothing like it before. Had it, I wildly speculated, been salvaged from some alien spacecraft? After a while, I started to doubt I had seen it at all. Then I became paranoid that they might be trying to brainwash me into thinking it was all a figment of my imagination. I have actually seen it, I kept saying to myself as I drove to and from the cafeteria day after day. I felt strangely proprietorial over it. Finally, I worried that it wasn't being treated right. It was that day that I decided I would have to leave. I didn't see it again until a few years later. I was back in the UK, having taken a job as the head of the material research group at King's College London. One afternoon, I was at home making a birthday card for my brother Dan, when they announced on the TV news that on January 2, 2004, the NASA mission to capture stardust had successfully engaged with the comet Wild 2. The news program then showed a picture of my material. Well, obviously not my material, but the material I desperately wanted to be mine. "So it was alien," I said triumphantly to my empty flat as I scrambled onto my computer to find out more. "They are harvesting it from space," I thought. Wrongly. The material turned out to be a substance known as aerogel. I had got the wrong end of the stick from the news report. It was the aerogel that was being used to collect the stardust. I didn't really stop to think about this, but ploughed on, collecting information about aerogels and their history. Aerogels were not of alien origin, I found out, but they nevertheless had a very strange backstory. They were invented in the 1930s by a man called Samuel Kistler, an American farmer turned chemist, who conjured them into existence solely to satisfy his curiosity about jelly. Jelly? What was jelly? He asked. He knew that it wasn't a liquid, but it wasn't really a solid either. It was, he decided, a liquid trapped in a solid prison, but one in which the prison bars were like an invisibly thin mesh. In the case of edible jelly, the mesh is made from long molecules of gelatin, which is derived from the protein collagen that makes up most connective tissues such as tendons, skin, and cartilage. When added to water, these gelatin molecules unravel and connect with one another to form a mesh that traps the liquid within it and prevents it from flowing. Thus, jelly is basically like a water balloon, but instead of being an outer skin that holds the water within, it inhabits the water from the inside. The water is held inside the mesh by a force known as surface tension, the same force that makes water feel wet and form drops, and causes it to stick to things. The surface tension forces inside the mesh are strong enough for the water to be unable to escape the jelly, but weak enough for it to slosh around, which is why jelly wobbles. It's also why jelly feels so amazing when you eat it. It's almost 100% water, and with a melting point of 35 degrees Celsius, the internal gelatin network promptly melts, freeing the water to burst in your mouth. The simple explanation, a liquid trapped by a solid internal mesh, was not enough for Samuel Kistler. He wanted to know whether the invisible gelatin mesh within a jelly was all of a piece. In other words, was it a coherent, independent internal skeleton, such that if you could find a way to remove all of the liquid from it, the mesh could stand on its own? To answer the question, he conducted a series of experiments, the results of which he published in a letter to the scientific journal Nature in 1931. The letter is entitled Coherent Expanded Aerogels and Jellies, and here is how he introduced the report. The continuity of the liquid permeating jellies is demonstrated by diffusion, synaerosis, and ultrafiltration, and the fact that the liquid may be replaced by other liquids of very diverse character indicates clearly that the gel structure may be independent of the liquid in which it is bathed. What he is saying in this opening paragraph is that various experiments have shown that the liquid in a jelly is connected throughout, rather than being compartmentalized, and can be replaced by other liquids. This demonstrates, in his opinion, that the solid internal skeleton may indeed be independent of the liquid in the jelly. And in using the word gel as a more general word for jelly, he is saying that this is true of a whole range of jelly-like materials that span the gap between being truly solid and truly liquid, from hair gel to solid chicken stock to setting cement, where the internal mesh is formed by calcium silicate fibrils. He goes on to point out that no one had yet managed to separate the liquid of a jelly from its internal skeleton. Hitherto, the attempt to remove the liquid by evaporation has resulted in shrinkage so great that the effect upon the structure may be profound. In other words, those in the past who have tried to remove the liquid by evaporation have found that the internal skeleton simply collapses. He then goes on to say triumphantly that he and his collaborators have found a way to do it. Mr. Charles Learned and I, with the kindly assistance and advice of Professor J.W. McBain, undertook to test the hypothesis that the liquid in a jelly can be replaced by a gas with little or no shrinkage. Our efforts have met with complete success. Their cunning idea was to replace the liquid with a gas while it was still inside the jelly, and so use the pressure of the gas to keep the skeleton from collapsing. First, though, they found a way to replace the water in the jelly with a liquid solvent. They used alcohol, which would be easier to manipulate. The danger of using a liquid solvent was that it, too, would evaporate, but they found a way to stop it. Mere evaporation would inevitably cause shrinkage. However, the jelly is placed in a closed autoclave with an excess of liquid, and the temperature is raised above the critical temperature of the liquid, while the pressure is maintained at all times at or above the vapor pressure, so that no evaporation of liquid can occur and consequently no contraction of the gel can be brought about by capillary forces at its surface. An autoclave is simply a pressure tank that can be heated. By increasing the pressure in the autoclave, the liquid inside the jelly is prevented from evaporating, even when the temperature is increased beyond its boiling point. The capillary forces he talks about, meanwhile, are caused by the surface tension of the liquid. Kistler speculates that when the liquid is gradually removed through evaporation, these same forces that hold the jelly together are responsible for tearing it apart. But when he raises the temperature of the whole jelly above the critical temperature, the point at which there is no difference between a gas and a liquid because both have the same density and structure, the whole liquid becomes a gas without going through the destructive process of evaporation. He says, "When the critical temperature is passed, the liquid has been converted directly into a permanent gas without discontinuity. The jelly has had no way of knowing that the liquid within its meshes has become a gas." This is a stroke of genius. Under the pressure from the autoclave, the newly created gas cannot escape from the jelly, and so the internal skeleton stays intact. All that remains is to allow the gas to escape, and there is left behind a coherent aerogel of unchanged volume. Only now does he let the gas escape slowly, leaving the internal skeleton of the jelly completely intact and mechanically sound, thus proving his hypothesis. It must have been a very satisfying moment. But he didn't stop there. These internal skeletons of jelly were incredibly light, fragile things, comprised mostly of air. They were, in fact, foams. Perhaps he could make them stronger, he thought, by making a jelly not out of gelatin, but out of something more rigid. So it was that he engineered a jelly in which the internal skeleton was made of the mineral silicon dioxide, the main constituent of glass. Using exactly the same process I've described, he then created from this jelly a silica aerogel, the lightest solid in the world. This was the material I had seen for a split second all those years ago in a laboratory in the desert. Not content with this achievement, Kistler went on to make other aerogels, and he lists them in the paper. "So far, we have prepared silica, alumina, nickel tartarate, stannic oxide, tungstic oxide, gelatin, agar, nitrocellulose, cellulose, and egg albumen aerogels, and see no reason why this list may not be extended indefinitely. Note that despite his triumph with silica aerogel, he couldn't resist making an aerogel from egg albumin, that's egg white. So while the rest of the world were using egg whites to cook light, fluffy omelets and bake cakes, Kistler did a different type of cooking using an autoclave to create egg aerogel, the lightest meringue in the world. Silica aerogel looks extremely odd. Put it against a light background and it disappears almost entirely. In this sense, it is harder to see, more invisible even, than normal glass, despite being less transparent. When light passes through glass, its path is distorted slightly. It is refracted, and the degree of distortion is known as glass's refractive index. In the case of aerogel, because there is simply less of the stuff, light's path is hardly distorted at all. For this same reason, there is no hint of reflection on its surfaces, and because of its ultra-low density, it appears to have no distinct edges, to be not fully solid at all. Which, of course, it isn't. The internal skeleton of a jelly has a structure not unlike that of bubble bath foam, with one main difference, which is that all of the holes link up. Silica aerogel is so full of holes that it is typically 99.8% air, and has a density only 3 times greater than air, which means that it has practically no weight at all. At the same time, when placed against a dark background, silica aerogel is undoubtedly blue, and yet, since it is made from clear glass, it ought to have no color at all. For many years, scientists wondered why this might be. The answer, when it came, was rather satisfyingly odd. When light from the sun enters the Earth's atmosphere, it hits all sorts of molecules, mostly nitrogen and oxygen molecules, on its way to Earth, and bounces off them like a pinball. This is called scattering, which means that on a clear day, if you look at any part of the sky, the light you see has been bouncing around the atmosphere before coming into your eye. If all light was scattered equally, the sky would look white. But it doesn't. The reason is that the shorter wavelengths of light are more likely to be scattered than the longer ones, which means that blue gets bounced around the sky more than reds and yellows. So instead of seeing a white sky when we look up, we see a blue one. This Rayleigh scattering, as it is called, is very slight indeed, so you need an enormous volume of gas molecules to see it. The sky works, but a room full of air doesn't. Put another way, any one bit of the sky doesn't look blue, but the whole atmosphere does. But if a small amount of air happens to be encapsulated in a transparent material that happens to contain billions and billions of tiny internal surfaces, then there will be sufficient Rayleigh scattering off these surfaces to change the color of any light that passes through it. Silica aerogel has exactly this structure, and this is where its blue hue comes from. So when you hold a piece of aerogel in your hand, it is, in a very real way, like holding a piece of sky. Aerogel foams have other interesting properties, the most remarkable of which is their thermal insulation, their ability to act as a barrier against heat. They are so good at this that you can put the flame of a Bunsen burner on one side of a piece of aerogel and a flower on the other, and still have a flower to sniff a few minutes later. Double glazing works by providing a gap between two glass panes which makes it hard for heat to conduct between them. Imagine that the atoms in glass are arranged like the audience in a rock concert, all packed together and dancing around. As the music gets louder and the audience dances more energetically, people knock into each other more. The same happens in the glass. As the material heats up, the atoms jiggle about more. The definition of the temperature of a material is, in fact, the degree to which the atoms in it are jiggling around. In the case of double glazing, though, there is a gap between the two glass panes, which means that the jiggling glass atoms in one pane find it hard to pass on their energy to those in the other. Of course, this works both ways. The same double glazing can be used to keep heat inside a building in the Arctic and to keep it outside a building in Dubai. Double glazed windows work well enough, but they still leak a lot of heat, as anyone who lives in a hot or cold country knows by looking at their energy bill. Could we do better? Well, there is, of course, triple glazing and quadruple glazing, which work by introducing a new layer of glass and so a new barrier to the heat transfer. But glass is dense, so these windows get heavier and bulkier and less transparent the more layers there are. Enter aerogel. Because it is a foam, it has within it the equivalent of 1 billion billion layers of glass and air between one side of the material and the other. This is what makes it such a superb thermal insulator. Having discovered this and other remarkable properties, Kistler reported them in the final sentence of his paper as follows. Apart from the scientific significance of these observations, the new physical properties developed in the materials are of unusual interest. Unusual interest indeed. He had discovered the best insulator in the world. The scientific community applauded briefly, but then promptly forgot all about aerogels. It was the 1930s, and they had other fish to fry. It was hard to know what would shape the future and what would be forgotten. In 1931, the year Kistler reported his invention of aerogels, the physicist Ernst Ruska created the first electron microscope. In the same edition of Nature in which Kistler published his findings, the Nobel Prize-winning materials scientist William Bragg reported his findings on the electron diffraction within crystals. These scientists paved the way for a new understanding of the inner structure of materials by developing the tools with which to see and visualize them. It was the first time that a new microscope had been invented since the optical microscope of the 16th century, and a whole new microscopic world was opening up. Soon, materials scientists were peering into metals, plastics, ceramics, and biological cells, and starting to understand how they worked from an atomic and molecular perspective. It was an exciting time. The world of materials was exploding, and materials scientists would soon deliver nylon, aluminum alloys, silicon chips, fiberglass, and many other revolutionary materials. Somehow, in all the excitement, aerogels got lost, and everyone forgot about them. Everyone except one man, Kistler himself. He decided that the beauty and thermal insulation properties of these jelly skeletons were so extraordinary that they should and must have a future. Although silica aerogel is as fragile and brittle as glass, for its weight, which is minuscule, it has good strength, certainly enough to make it industrially useful. So he patented it and sold the license to manufacture it to a chemical company called Monsanto Corporation. By 1948, it was making a product called Santagel, which was a powdered form of silica aerogel. Santagel seemed to have a bright future as the best thermal insulator in the world, but alas, the time was not right for it. Energy was getting cheaper and cheaper, not more expensive, and there was no awareness of the problem of global warming. An expensive thermal insulator like aerogel just didn't make economic sense. Having failed to find a market in thermal insulators, Monsanto rather bizarrely found applications for it in various inks and paints, its role being to flatten them optically by scattering light, creating a matte finish. Aerogel finally ended up being used ignominiously as a thickening agent in screwworm salves for sheep and in the jelly used to create napalm for bombs. In the 1960s and 1970s, cheaper alternatives usurped aerogel, even from this rather limited repertoire of applications, and finally Monsanto gave up making it altogether. Kistler died in 1975, having never seen his most wonderful material find a place in the world. The revival of aerogels came not as a result of any commercial application, but because their unique properties attracted the attention of some particle physicists at CERN, studying something called Cherenkov radiation. This is the radiation given off by a subatomic particle when it travels through a material faster than light can travel through it. Detecting and analyzing this radiation gives clues to the nature of the particle and so provides a very exotic means of identifying which of the many invisible particles the scientists are dealing with. Aerogel is extremely useful for this purpose, providing a material through which the particle can travel, as it is, effectively, a solid version of a gas, and it continues to be used for this today, helping physicists unravel the mysteries of the subatomic world. Once aerogels found their way into physicists' labs with their sophisticated equipment, esoteric aims, and big budgets, the material's reputation started to grow again. At that time, in the early 1980s, aerogels were so expensive to make that they could only live in labs where money was no object. CERN was one such lab, but soon NASA followed. The first applications of silica aerogels in space exploration were to insulate equipment from extreme temperatures. Aerogels are particularly suitable for this application because not only are they the best insulators in the world, but they are also extremely light, and when you're launching spacecraft out of the gravitational pull of the Earth, reducing weight matters rather a lot. Aerogel was used first in 1997 on the Mars Pathfinder mission, and has been used as an insulator on spacecraft ever since. But once the scientists at NASA found that aerogel could cope with space travel, they realized that the material had another possible use. If you look up into the sky on a clear night, you might see a shooting star, which appears as a bright trail of light crossing the sky. For a long